The third case for oral argument this morning is Kelly Jo Krebs Appellant versus Jason Allen Krebs Appellee. For the appellant is Mr. Ronald Parsons, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Mr. Gregory Brewers, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. I would remind the audience that when you leave this morning, feel free to help yourselves to the publications out on the table. They are available at no cost. With that, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. We're here today on an issue involving the application of our legal standards to a child custody decision, which is something that courts and judges have been wrestling with in our legal traditions going back to the wisdom of Solomon, where we derive the phrase splitting the baby. But in a way, splitting the baby is exactly what courts are asked to do as they determine how children's time will be divided between divorced parents who love them equally. It's no easy thing, even when parents live in the same city within a few miles of each other. And here the parties live in different states. And while we certainly cannot expect perfection from our trial courts, this court has established workable legal standards for making child custody determinations, and it has enforced those standards by insisting that they be applied carefully and properly to govern the trial court's decision so that the best interests of the children, rather than some subjective or arbitrary choosing of sides or complaints of one parent about the other, govern these critical decisions, which are, I think we all agree, as critical as any other decision that a trial court initially makes and that this court very carefully reviews. I'd like to spend just a moment or two on the facts and then talk about the governing standards and about why we believe that the trial court abused its discretion in this particular case. Kelly Weiss and Jason Krebs began dating in the spring of 2002 after they met on a church mission trip to Russia. They lived in near Des Moines, Iowa. A baby was conceived in September of that year. A wedding was then planned, and they were married in January of 2003. Their son, Dylan, was then born in June of 2003, about 6 months later. It was a two-and-a-half-year marriage that did not go well. The erosion was slow at first, but it ended very suddenly on a night in May of 2005. And the parties have two very different perceptions about what occurred on that night, and as the court knows, the reality is probably somewhere in between those two perceptions. But what matters is that after that night, the marriage was irrevocably over. Kelly was a med school graduate, and after trying a residency in internal medicine, she decided that wasn't for her, and she decided to change her focus to psychiatry. And it's a more flexible and a family-friendly residency. They had decided at the time of the separation that they were both going to, prior to the separation, that they were both going to move to Sioux Falls where she could pursue this program, and they were in the process of moving when they separated in May. At the time, Kelly was pregnant with twin girls. So after this May evening, Kelly moved to Sioux Falls with Dylan, their two-and-a-half-year son, or about their two-year-old son at that time. The Iowa courts granted her temporary custody of Dylan, and eventually the Iowa courts granted the divorce. The custody decision was transferred to the South Dakota courts, where Kelly lived and Dylan was, where their two new twin baby daughters, Faith and Grace, were born, and where Kelly had her parents and her family. Jason remained behind in Iowa. In 2007, the South Dakota courts entered their first temporary custody order. It was Judge Zell on the file at that time. And that first temporary custody decision granted Kelly physical custody with visitation every weekend for Jason, I believe, three times in Sioux Falls and one time not for overnight in Iowa of the 4 weeks in a month. Then a second custody order was entered in 2007, and it also granted physical custody to Kelly and changed the visitation to every other weekend, but for longer periods and some overnights. Kelly adhered to the schedule, and Jason received his visitation according to the schedule established not by Kelly but by the South Dakota courts.
What was the custody of the twins, or the visitation, I mean?
The visitation for the twins was, initially, it was every week for a few hours, or about a few hours.
Now, does it say few hours? Because that becomes a dispute. What, does it just say few hours?
The actual custody order is on page 214, or 244 of the record, and let's see, and it states... Or actually, it's on page 145, the first custody order, and it states, defendant shall have visitation with the minor children every weekend, commencing on Saturday, December 9th, 2006, at 12 p.m., and continuing every weekend thereafter until 3 p.m. on Saturday. And then there's different times for Sunday. So it was a very specific order.
But what about the twins? Did that cover the twins?
That covered the twins, all three children. That's page 144 of the record, the first order. And then there was a second order that modified it, but also I believe was specific. The question about the amount of time for visitation comes in the nebulous area before there was a visitation schedule while the twins were infants during the first year of their lives, because the first temporary custody order entered in South Dakota occurred about a year after they were born. So that's the nebulous period, and during that time, there was visitation. It was not what Jason wanted, and it was at a hotel where they would meet, and the hotel requirement was something insisted upon, as he testified at the hearing, that he wanted, because he would refuse to meet with her alone when they were not in public because of the controversy surrounding their separation.
All right. Mr. Parsons, as I understand, you're saying now that period where there was the hotel visitation was prior to Judge Zell's first order?
Well, they also continued to meet at hotels after that, but I think the period of complaint where there was no order, the schedule was followed once the order was set, except for a few weather-related issues. And so the thing I think the trial court focused on and was Jason's main complaint was that after she moved, the first year after the divorce, when things were still, communication was always poor, and there had not yet been a temporary custody order entered in South Dakota. After the temporary custody order was entered in South Dakota, the schedule was followed, you know, substantially. And
can I ask about that first year? Because that's one thing I think that the trial court focused on, talking about the mother's decision to breastfeed the children as she had the older boy.
Yes.
And as I understand it, the mother's reason for only allowing the father to have about 2 hours of visitation a month for the first year was because any other schedule would interfere with her breastfeeding schedule. Is that right?
That's correct. And that is something that Judge Zell continued even after he entered his custody order. And the reason he did that, I think if this court reads anything in the record other than the custody evaluation itself, it should read the transcript of Judge Zell's ruling at that first temporary custody hearing. Because he explains, you know, this is a difficult situation, and it's difficult not because of any fault of the kids, but because we have parties living in different states. And the South Dakota visitation guidelines that are published on this court's website are very specific. And Section 2 talks about visitation for the non-custodial parent when children are under age 5. And it talks in terms of hourly stretches. There will be no overnights for nursing infants. I mean, that's very clear, and that's also in a previous section, Section 1.16.
During that first year, did the twins spend some of the time in daycare?
I think they probably did. She was in her residency,
so the children then during the daytime would be in daycare. Presumably 5 hours a day, maybe, or something of that nature, if she were in residency?
I don't think the record states explicitly. I mean, she had help from her parents. Her parents lived in Parkston.
What,
she has a brother and sister.
What troubles me is that she's saying dad can only see the kids 2 hours a month. However, I'm going to have the kids in daycare with a non-relative for hours and hours every week, maybe, you know, eight hours a day. I don't know what it would be. So here the dad gets very limited time with the children, and non-family members end up with the children. Obviously, the kids aren't getting breastfed in daycare.
Well, you know, it's not that she said that there will be no other visitation. I mean, that's the record, you know, is conflicting on that, and the trial.
That's the anecdote the court seems to be using, is that he, you know, she prefers strangers to the dad.
Well, the problem was he lived in Iowa and worked in Iowa, and so he could not come up during the week. And so,
right, but still on the weekends, 2 hours a month, you know, 1 hour for half an hour on either side of the visit with the older boy. I'm just wondering what her justification would be for so limiting the father, but not limiting having the kids in daycare as long as she needed them there.
Well, and I don't think the record shows they were in daycare that whole time, but
okay.
But yes, no, it was not an ideal situation, and we needed the court's involvement, and that was clear. I mean, this court's recognizing decisions like the Peters Act decision, I think, with Justice Konecamp authored, that
but that doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We don't punish parents for wanting to spend all of their allotted time or as much time as they can with the kids. I mean, Jason wanted to spend as much time as he could. She wanted to spend as much time with the kids as she could. And when you're talking about these quarrels about I should have gotten more, you should have dropped them off, that's not what the trial court's supposed to be looking at.
Well, in essence now, with the twins being, I think they're over three, aren't they?
Yes.
We kind of moved beyond that difficulty. I assume that they're, you know, adult food or whatever.
We have. We have moved beyond that, and now Kelly gets visitation, and not as much as she would like. But we're going back in time to the custody decision, and we're...
But you want custody, not more visitation, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. We're contending that the trial court clearly abused its discretion. Under this court's governing standards, when it removed the children from Kelly's primary physical custody that was established through several temporary orders, not permanent orders, and changed custody, sent them off to Iowa. Now, the standard of review, I think, is important in this case. Standards of review are critical to how this court does its work. The standard of review is abuse of discretion, and that's a high burden. But reading this court's cases, I think the Heinen case summarizes it well. This court does not mean, as the opposing brief seems to suggest, that child custody decisions are not reviewable and that they will not be looked at very carefully. This court reviews the trial court's decision for incorrectly choosing, interpreting, or applying the law. We think that occurred here very clearly, for clear mistakes in fact findings and for undue emphasis on matters not material related to the child's welfare. And I think I find it very interesting that the legislature, I'm not aware of any other situation where the legislature has passed a statute, SDCL 25446, emphasizing to the court that all custody orders are subject to revision on appeal in all particulars, including those which are stated to be in the discretion of the court. So the legislature has spoken very clearly. We want you to take a very hard look at these decisions and make changes where you feel it's appropriate.
I mean, I have a question I'm just dying to ask you.
Yes.
Because it really is weighing on me. In this case, the court appointed an expert, Dr. Claiborne, and we've seen his work in the many appeals, and not to tag you with this, but it seems to me that in your brief you speak highly of him and urge us to use his decision. But, you know, at one point he says in the trial, correct me if I'm wrong, he says the court couldn't make a mistake if it gave custody to either parent. And if that's true, how do we say there was an abuse of discretion when the court decides to give custody to the dad?
That's a great question. It came from his report, I think he's reading from his report on page 19. And what he said was actually, I think we have to look at it in the context he made that comment. He said, it would not be error to place the children with either parent, with either parent. And he said it in the context where immediately thereafter he said, because both parents have the capabilities to provide adequate care. What he's essentially saying is both parents are fit parents. And that's not disputed. They're both good people. They both can take care of the children. They're both fit parents. He then went on to say, but this court, or but this expert, I have made the determination, and this is what he does for a living, based on all of the information I gathered, that Kelly should retain primary care, and that it may actually be detrimental to these children to remove them from her primary care. And that's reflected in the South Dakota visitation guidelines. So I do, but going back to your question then, so how can it be an abuse of discretion? Because if it's not, if it can never be abuse of discretion where you have two fit parents, then we don't need standards. Then the standards mean nothing. Because if both parents are good people, and it's never a mistake to give one to either person, then a trial court's decision would just be completely arbitrary. We can't.
But if they're both good people, aren't you in essence inviting us to retry the case?
Not at all. I'm asking the court to insist that the standards be applied. That the Furstenberg factors be applied properly, and that factual findings that are clearly erroneous be remedied.
Well, let's go to those factual findings for a minute. You know, I haven't added them up exactly, but just as I read the court's decision, there's over 100 findings that the court made about the parents on, under the Furstenberg factors. In other words, whether they're good or bad, disfavors one or the other. And as I counted it, and this isn't going to be numerically accurate, but most of the findings, between findings 46 and 100, which is approximately 54 findings, are all findings where the court ruled against or found against your client.
And
so it seems to me you take issue with about three or four findings you really focus on. But here we've got somewhere around 50 findings by this trial court that all favor the other side.
And in doing so, virtually all of those findings deal with this alleged claim that there was alienation of the children from their father by Kelly. Virtually all of those.
But doesn't the trial court also enter a finding that they find your client not credible?
That was inserted in there, yes. That was not something he said in his oral ruling at the hearing.
But he doesn't have to.
Doesn't have to. I mean, we know the process. The attorney drafts the findings of fact, and the judge signs them. I'm not. That's how it works. I accept that. But the trial judge at the hearing found that they were both good people. He thought that there was some alienation, but he suggested it was subconscious. And really what happened here is rather than focusing on the first number of factors, most of them are equal in this case, don't favor either party. The one big one, and it's the one recognized in the guidelines, and this court's cases have said often it comes down to this factor, because this factor really affects the children. Who was the primary caretaker? And, you know, she was the primary caretaker for the children, for the twins all of their lives, of course, and before the separation, Jason's own affidavits admit that she was the one taking care of the kids, staying home with the kids, taking them to their medical appointments for all the 4 months of a 2.5-year marriage. So then we get to the fine, you know, and the court basically kind of admitted that at the hearing too. Yes, she was the primary caretaker. Then we get these written findings that say, well, there really wasn't a primary caretaker. And that was a distortion of the truth, the reality. And that was clearly erroneous. She was the primary caretaker. So when we have to rely on these tests, or it becomes arbitrary, it becomes a flip of the coin, or who do you like better? There has to be some review, and we have to apply these standards. And the standard is best interest of the child based on these factors. And there's one glaring factor that completely heavily weighs one parent, and that factor is disregarded, and a contrary finding is made that's erroneous. I think the standard should be enforced, and this, that's an abuse of discretion.
Well, we've said, too, that trial judges aren't just simply supposed to just sign off on findings, you know, that are prepared by lawyers. And you look at the court's comments after the its oral decision, and an awful lot of the findings it makes later on, you know, I don't know if the trial judge actually made those findings intellectually or whether he just signed off on them. It's hard to say because his oral comments don't reflect all that.
The oral comments talk about these, and the judge actually said, and the trial court said, you know, it's my job to try to discern broad themes. And I think the court was trying to buy into a narrative here, and Jason had one ready. She, you know, didn't tell me about medical appointments. She's trying to keep me away from the kids. She followed these visitation orders, and the evidence is undisputed. There's no alienation. These kids are bonded to everyone in both families. You know, the grandparents, Jason's grandparents, they're bonded. There's no alienation. There's no successful alienation. All there was an attempt. She wants to spend her time, as much time as she can with the kids, and so does he. So to punish her for that, and to do so on the basis of things that, you know, the finding that the judge, that the trial court made is that she did not give extra time to Jason.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Brewer, do you have 20 minutes, sir?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I wanted to, first of all, indicate that I think my colleague is absolutely right in terms of two loving parents in this case. There's no question about that.
And competent parents. I mean, both parents know how to take care of an infant. It wasn't a situation where the husband or the father didn't know how to care for infants. He did know how to do that.
That's correct, yes. In fact, you raised that point. While Kelly and Jason were together, they shared very much in terms of who was going to take care of the kids and so forth. A classic example of that was while Kelly was going to attend a residency program in Missouri for her medical training, Jason reduced his hours down to 3 days a week, and that was back in Des Moines. And he would take the older child, who was at that point just a toddler. He'd take that child back and forth, and he'd take care of him just like as if Kelly were in the Des Moines area still working. Jason certainly picked up the slack and did what it took to be a father. One of the problems that we have in this case is that the twins, the two younger ones, of course, were born after they separated. And that's one of the difficult parts of this case. And it starts to show you, I think, some of the underlying problems in terms of the way that Kelly treated Jason in terms of, are these kids really going to have the benefit of a father in their life? And that, what I like to refer to as the ability to foster a relationship, not necessarily just alienate the children, but can she foster a relationship with them? And that's an extremely important part.
You know, along that line, however, it seems like the trial court judge put a lot of emphasis and made findings on the fact that, and held it against the mother, that she didn't give him extra time. Now, that obviously is not a standard that we would normally look at as a trial court or our review of a trial court, that somehow you're going to hold it against one parent if they don't give them extra time beyond what the court has ordered. Obviously, what we look at here is a court order. Now, did she follow the court orders?
No. Let me explain, first of all. Even under South Dakota law, until the judge enters an order specifying what the visitation should be, we already have the provision that the South Dakota visitation guidelines should go into effect. That's an important consideration in this case because it took a long time before Judge Zell actually had the opportunity to enter that initial order. The case started in Iowa. got moved to South Dakota. Motions were made back and forth. The parties were trying to work on the negotiations. And by the time Judge Zell actually entered his first order, about a year had passed after the twins were already born. And it was during that time that, at best, Jason got about an hour every 2 weeks. Under the circumstances, the South Dakota visitation guidelines should have picked up the slack, where the court system did not allow them to get a written order from the judge specifying the hours.
What do the guidelines say when you have distances involved, when you have small children nursing? Does it address that
situation? It doesn't specifically address that, at least not to my recollection. What it seems to do, though, is say that when a parent is available, and this applies regardless of age, when the parent is available, they travel the long distance, they're there in town, there should be that opportunity to spend that significant time with those children. And I think it's clear, as was pointed out in terms of some of the daycare issues, that wasn't being done here. Kelly decided that it was better to limit it to the half hour for whatever reason. I'm not sure that Kelly even understands or understood it, and that was one thing that Judge Hoffman picked up on, is she hasn't quite internalized yet the importance of the relationship between dad and these kids. And that is something that I think the court needs to recognize.
Now, that Dr. Claiborne addressed that in his report, didn't he?
To some extent. He didn't make it much of an issue.
And from my reading of the record and so forth, it appears that really there isn't any alienation, because the children are bonded to your client as well, right?
I would say that's correct, that they were not, in fact, alienated to the extent that they did not have a loving relationship with
them. So isn't that finding of fact clearly erroneous?
No, because he was talking about the attempts to alienate and the failure to foster that relationship, which took many forms, I think. Judge Hoffman talked about basically a profound inability of Kelly to understand the importance of that relationship, the importance of allowing it to develop, the importance of recognizing that Jason, not only does he have an interest, but he has a lot to bring to the table for these kids. He wanted to be involved, and that was a finding that Judge Hoffman made, that every step of the way, Jason had to fight for what he got.
I'm troubled by the court's, I mean, I read the court's opinion, they issued that from the bench, and then I read his findings, and I wonder where all those findings that are in all those 100 findings come from, because obviously the judge didn't even mention some of these things. He didn't even allude to them. And yet there's all these findings that are made in there, and I'm assuming that you drafted those findings for him, and he signed them. And, you know, oftentimes you see a judge issue a memorandum opinion or give a lengthy decision, and then those findings kind of track it. But a lot of these findings don't seem to track anything. It looks like the judge just took what you said were the findings, were his findings, and he just agreed with them. Is that right, or am I misunderstanding something?
He modified them also. He did, in fact, I think in the final version, there's one or two of them that actually has some written notes on them. So he was studying this case. He was looking at the details of what was presented to him. And for the most part, I hate to pat myself on the back, but I do think that I tried very hard to listen to what he was saying and give him a draft that seemed consistent with what he was saying.
But you have to agree that there's some findings in there that he never mentioned at all or even alluded to in his decision.
Not of anything necessarily relevant to the case, I don't believe. For instance, there was the child's preference, which I think, you know, I don't think he ever addressed that, but it's certainly in there. Separation of siblings, I don't know that he ever addressed that in his oral findings, but it's in there, which I think is common that we would at least address those issues.
I'm not saying there's anything improper, because I understand that this is our system. The lawyers submit proposed findings and the court enters them. But I, you know, there's a delicate balance there where we expect that the decision the judge signs is the judge's decision, not the lawyer's decision that the judge signs off and rubber stamps. That's the question. You know.
Certainly that's the way the game is played. I do think that, in fact, Judge Hoffman's oral decision was completely consistent with his written findings, though. I feel strongly about the way that was done.
Did I understand you to say you submitted more than one proposed set?
Honestly, I'm not sure that there was more than one proposed set. I just know for sure that he did have written notes or modifications to what was submitted.
So he read what you put before him. He didn't just sign it. He read it and edited it.
Correct.
Well, the other part that bothers me is the amount of weight and that the trial court put on the fact that this mother decided to nurse her infants, and then later that's held against her.
We certainly
don't want to say that.
I'd love to address that, and I was hoping to address that. The amount of weight that was put on it, in my opinion, came as a result of this appeal, not necessarily the result of Judge Hoffman's actual determination.
But he says it in his opinion.
He does.
He says it on the record.
Yes.
Makes quite a strong statement on the record, which is reflected in the findings that he signed.
Yes. It is one of those factors that he did take and say, this is an example of how I believe Kelly just, lack of better words, just doesn't get it, just doesn't understand the importance of allowing dad to be involved with these kids. The nursing issue was discussed, I believe, with Justice Konenkamp earlier. The nursing part of that, the kids were actually in daycare for, I believe, about 12 hours a day. They had a nanny. In fact, they went through several nannies. Then they went through several daycares. All that time, Kelly is saying, we can't expand this visitation because I'm nursing. The kids were 3 years old. They're almost 3 years old at the time of trial, and they were still nursing.
All right, Mr. Brewer, we're talking about expanding visitation. That gets back to a question you were asked earlier, I believe, by Justice Meyer Henry on the order, and you went immediately back to the guidelines, but was there a violation of Judge Zell's two order?
There was a period of about 12 weeks where the visits did not occur in Iowa. I believe that's a violation. There were violations in terms of some of the holidays. There were violations in terms of working with the custody evaluator, which required obviously that the kids be allowed to be with Jason for a period of time. Was there, for instance, a lack of the regular weekends when Jason would travel to South Dakota? No. He got exactly what was ordered. And I agree that there is, and this court has said, we're not going to hold somebody at fault for wanting to spend time with their kids. And if the visitation order is such that that's the way it works out, that it's supposed to be a few hours on Saturday, a few hours on Sunday, then that's what the parents get. However, it goes to the understanding of what Kelly's mindset was and the importance of father in these kids' lives. I think it also goes... This is a case in which Kelly clearly believes that these kids are more hers than they are Jason's. And there's a lot of examples of that. The daycare, for instance. Jason tried to get information about all these daycares, all these nannies, and he couldn't. He couldn't even get a name from Kelly. Medical issues. He tried to be involved with the kids' medical issues, even though he lives a few hundred miles apart. And he never was given the opportunity to be there, to know about the appointments in advance. These parents had joint legal custody, and that should have been done. In regard to kindergarten enrollment, that was another example that Judge Hoffman picked out and said, look, it's not so important whether or not the oldest son went to kindergarten last year or this year. In fact, he's in kindergarten this year. That's not the point. The point is she couldn't even sit down and talk about that with Jason. She imposed her will to the exclusion of Jason's. In regards to naming of the twins, each of these kids, the two twins, daughters, they're about 3 years old, well, going on 4 years old now. They have five names. Jason wasn't ever consulted about that. The nursing issue, I think, is a clear example that it's okay if Kelly picks out someone else to watch the kids for daycare. It's okay if we pick a stranger off the street who spends 12 hours a day with the child. But Dad should get a half hour. Dad should get those couple of hours that are allowed by the court order. And even though he's sitting here in Sioux Falls at a motel waiting to see his kids, he's not allowed any extra time. He's not allowed any extra time when Dr. Claiborne needs to have the kids in the house. It's another example that I wanted to bring out. In December, it was getting close to Christmas. Dr. Claiborne was supposed to be there. In fact, the custody evaluation was supposed to be done by the end of that year, 2007. And Dr. Claiborne has a policy that says, I want the kids there for a couple of days so that I can see how they've adjusted. We couldn't get that done without a court order. We could not get those kids to Jason's house. Even though they were supposed to be there for a couple of days, Kelly's position was, well, Dr. Claiborne should have gone there when it was Jason's time. Jason had the kids from noon on Saturday until like 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. It's exactly what Dr. Claiborne did want. But Kelly's approach was, that's what it should be. Because the rest is my time.
Dr. Claiborne identified the problem, not so much as Kelly, but as a lack of the parties being able to communicate. And communication takes two. So why would Claiborne not... Claiborne did not say that Kelly was alienating them. He said this couple has a very difficult time communicating, is my recollection when I read it.
Correct. And Judge Hoffman...
So you're presenting here as if there's no lack of communication or the communicate. Do you dispute, I guess I would question, whether Claiborne's analysis of that was accurate?
Yes, I do dispute that.
Okay.
And there are a couple of reasons if you want me to give some examples here.
There is a disturbing fact about your client videotaping the exchange of the children. You know, that... goodness, that has this gives you a sense that these people are really having a hard time communicating with each other when he feels he has to videotape the transactions, which sort of dovetails with what Dr. Claiborne is saying.
The videotaping occurred very early on in the process, and I think there were some problems in that regard coming from both sides. Jason was told to stop doing that, and he did stop doing that. In terms of Dr. Claiborne's analysis regarding the alienation process, when we talk about the failure to foster, I think we have to look at the motivation here of what Kelly was really trying to do. Keep in mind that she was telling Dr. Claiborne that there was pornography, that there was smoking in the house, that there are some bad morals going on. She presented Dr. Claiborne with pictures 5 years before Kelly and Jason ever even met. Jason was out with some college buddies out on a boat, and apparently some pictures were taken of some others at that gathering. Kelly presented that to Dr. Claiborne and said, here, look at his morals. And that did impact Dr. Claiborne. He did look at that. And although he says, well, yeah, I could tell that the pictures were old, he questioned Jason's morals as a result of that. And in terms of the ability of Kelly to internalize what some of these things do, how they would affect, in this case, Dr. Claiborne, who's a professional, how is that going to affect the kids? If the same mentality can affect Dr. Claiborne, how is it that the kids are going to survive without being alienated? It's an extremely important concept here. Dr. Claiborne got caught up in it. The judge heard the whole story, and the judge saw the whole picture. The big picture is that when you add up the various factors, Jason, between two loving parents, is the one who can be the better custodial parent. Kelly can be a great parent. So can Jason. But when it comes to the custodial role, there are certain inherent factors in that role that I think Judge Hoffman clearly touched upon, and he got it right. He saw it for what it is. He also believed that Jason was the more stable parent, the one who's been there the longest. He's got the stable job, the house, the fiance. He's got the schools. He's got the daycare. And he is the one who is more likely to offer that stability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brewers. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I found it interesting when my friend and colleague was challenged on some of the behaviors of Jason that his response was, well, that was early on in the process. So it really is the key to this and the key to the trial court's decision. Virtually all of the complaints that Jason advanced and the trial court relied upon were early on in the process while this bitter, fearful divorce happened and the communication was bad and there was no custody order in place. The decision to nurse during the first year and problems with the amount of visitation before a custody schedule was established. All of these complaints were early on in the process. We had before the custody hearing 2 years of a visitation schedule followed by the parties. And if you'll read Dr. Claiborne's report, both parties stated to him that it was working. We have minor snafus with some of the exchanges, but this is working. But then when we get to the hearing, the theme becomes, well, let's focus back on after these people first broke up and we had a lot of trouble getting a system in place. And that was an improper focus of the trial court.
Are you seeking an outright reversal here, or are you seeking a retrial?
We're seeking a reversal, Your Honor. We would accept a retrial if that was this court's judgment, but because it's important, it makes a difference because changing custody is a lot different standard than an initial custody decision. But we think, on this record, the custody decision was an abuse of discretion and should be reversed. Because of the factors, because of the standards this court says has to be applied. And if you look to the hearing, if you look to the actual ruling, the factors are glossed over. They said, the court basically says, well, they're all kind of equal, but I'm going to discern these broad themes. I have some telltale examples that show her subconscious efforts. And it goes into a lot of time is spent on this nursing issue. I thought it very an improper focus because it's not something that should be held against her. The guidelines say specifically, until weaning has occurred without forcing, a nursing infant should have visits of only a few hours with the father.
But that's a few hours a visit, not a few hours a month. And that's what father was getting, 2 hours a month, and the guidelines say a few hours per visit.
Yeah, I think it was more than a few hours a month, but that's true. The trial court says, though, I see on page 248, I see no reason why these children should not have been able to travel and spend significant time in overnight visits with their father within weeks of their birth. There is no reason to believe that it would have been an inappropriate situation. It's as though the trial court's not aware of the South Dakota visitation guidelines. And the trial court never mentions the South Dakota visitation guidelines.
Well, the mother could, she could always send some breast milk with the father, and that's a common thing nowadays, to send breast milk to the daycare or send it to her, or if the mother's going to be gone, the father. But yeah. But obviously, she couldn't do that for days or weeks.
And actually, it says forcibly weaning the child, whether breastfeeding or bottle feeding. It's the nursing aspect with the primary caregiver. And you compare that with the temporary custody order by Judge Zell, who says, you know, if you folks were living within a few miles, 10, 15, 20 miles of each other, the court would be looking at contact anywhere from 2 to 3 times a week or for 2 to 3 hours at a time. And even depending upon the relationship that exists, maybe an overnight visit. But that's not realistic here. It wasn't at that time. And for the first year, it wasn't. But after the first year, we had custody orders in place for the next several years, and they worked, and they were followed. Read Jason's testimony in the trial transcript. He admits he can't come up with he tried to come up with an occasion where something wasn't followed. It was weather-related or something like that, or an exchange was missed. But in general, this plan was followed. You look at the custody report. I mean, I don't want to lose sight of that, because this is the expert. This is the person who spent days upon days with these families, studied the records. He found that Kelly was the parent that was slightly favored in encouraging one parent's relationship with the other. He didn't say it was equal. He said, both do it, but I find Kelly slightly favored. And at the hearing, he's asked about that. Well, why do you have some hesitancy if Jason were to have custody? And he said, well, I'm a little concerned about the animosity Jason has for Kelly, but I do think he would encourage it. There was concern. I mean, this is not a case of, we're hearing about complaints or that Kelly made about Jason. Jason was calling her crazy. He says she's mentally unstable. He calls her a liar. He says she's not, doesn't provide adequate care. I mean, the accusations fly, but what we have to get to is the reality of the situation and find the facts based on the standard. And the standard places a lot of weight, when everything else is equal, on who is the primary caregiver. And that factual finding made by the trial court was simply inaccurate, clearly erroneous, and that was the pivotal finding. And the rest of what the trial court relied upon.
Well, it's only clearly erroneous if we say that Dr. Claiborne is right. I mean, isn't that, I mean, he was at liberty to disregard Dr. Claiborne's conclusion, wasn't he?
Certainly he was, but clearly for the twins, they had never lived with Jason.
Is that more pivotal than the finding that your client was found to be not credible?
Well, you know, it doesn't say why. There's just a general finding, she's not credible, drafted by Mr. Brewers, not mentioned in the hearing. He signed it. I can't disregard the fact that he signed it. But I think if you're finding someone not credible, the trial court has an obligation to explain why and not just throw that in there. The trial court did make a couple notes on the submitted findings. There was just one set, and I think there's two places. He says you could have bottle-fed or given supplements to the nursing infants so they could be on overnight visits, and then instead of visitation, he said liberal visitation. And there's just a few notes. I'm not arguing with the process. But what I'm saying is that this court focused on things that were not material. The factors were put off to the side. The primary factor that I believe was disputed in this case and controlling in this case was a clearly erroneous factual finding. And instead, the focus is put on this alienation theme. Dr. Claiborne found that she fully understood that she wanted Jason to be part of the kids' lives, and they were. He was. His family was a part of these children's lives for 2 years. Read Jason's father's testimony and his mother's testimony about how wonderful time they have, how well bonded they are. There is no alienation. That was something seized upon as a rationale rather than the factors that this court should apply. Rather than the balanced and systematic approach that this court requires looking for the best interests of the children. This court, we respectfully suggest, was concerned with these complaints that mostly occurred early on, right after, within the first year of this bitter divorce. And in essence, the trial court blamed and punished Kelly for Jason's understandable frustration with the inherent difficulties that were produced by a visitation schedule resulting from the fact that the parties lived 300 miles apart. Both, neither side was going to be happy, but to blame Kelly for that was an abuse of discretion, and to absolve Jason of all blame for the lack of communication.
Let's take it back a little more globally just to finish up here. You know, when you look at the evaluation by Dr. Claiborne, and you see that he essentially found the parents were equal in all of the first degree factors.
Yes.
Except for two. And in those two areas, he said mother was only slightly favored. Almost by definition, how can you say that it's an abuse of discretion for the trial court to disagree?
Well, he said slightly favored in the that Kelly was slightly favored, encouraging contact with the other parent.
What I'm saying is, that's exactly the kind of balanced and methodical approach that you just referred to, and that is supposed to be done. And here, out of all those factors, there's just two slight differences.
But the problem is, the balanced and methodical approach was done by Dr. Claiborne, and his findings were rejected by the trial court. And he disagreed with the two findings that were disputed. And I'm saying those findings were wrong, clearly erroneous. There's no way she was not the primary caretaker. All but 4 months of their marriage, and for the rest of the children's lives up until they custody was changed, she took care of the kids. Now, they claim, well, that's an unfair advantage that she has because she had the children. But that's not the question. We're not talking about which side got treated the most equitably, who got a litigation advantage. That's not the inquiry. The inquiry is, what is the best interest of the children based on these factors?
And your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.